We've scoured the web for the best stories about families, relationships, and mental health. Get the latest news about your brain on Facebook, explaining vacations, and what to do about delinquent friends this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And just like you heard at the beginning, we're talking about three research stories today, three news stories. Once again, it's three things.
Three things, yes.
Very exciting, interesting things, yes. I'm sure. No doubt. It's funny, this was one of those weird weeks where there were so many things to talk about that
we had six things to begin with.
We had six things that we had to pare down, which means we wound up having to do a lot of reading about things that we're not even going to talk about today.
That's right, but we found that the best top three things we of the top six that we were looking at.
The so cream really did rise
show
to the top.
Up. Yes.
Sort of.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
You could say that. You know, we had some, it's funny because when you're trying to pick out things to talk about on an episode like this, where we have a whole bunch of different things, you sort of wind up judging a book by its cover a little bit at the beginning, and you pick stories based on their titles, or maybe you see a news headline that looks interesting. And we had like Caught in a Bad Romance and all.
That's right. That was a catchy Lady Gaga type title.
That's right. And
brilliant.
Then you read it and said, this is giving me a headache.
That's right.
And then I was like, well, I saw the title. I haven't even looked at it yet until, you know, I was preparing for it earlier. And I'm like, okay, yeah, you're not wrong.
I even forget exactly. I remember writing you something about, I don't know about that bad romance research article. I think it says something about if you and your spouse are critical, then you're unhappy later.
Yeah.
Was it something like that?
It was one of those studies where you're like, okay, you needed to do a research study to figure this out. Good.
Yes.
That's good. So we did not choose that one, we've already spoken about it.
Yes.
Go figure. But we did bring three stories today, and I think the first one is one that you brought along about.
Well, it's called Online Social Network Sizes Reflected in Human Brain Structure.
Okay,
so basically, you know, if you have a large group of friends on Facebook, you have a much bigger brain, and your cranium has to, you know, grow to accommodate this massive.
Very
brain.
Exciting, and you also actually found the second story, which is about how talking about fun things that happen in your life ruins your fun.
No, but talking about mundane things. Well, anyway, let's not give everything.
No, we don't want to. We don't want people to totally tune out. And then the third one is one that I thought right away when I looked at this, I thought, okay, this is something that I've been asked about. I've thought about it with my own kids. You've probably, if you haven't yet,
definitely.
It's going to come up. And it's about what should parents do if their kids are hanging around delinquent friends?
Right.
Does cutting off contact help?
I mean, what parent of a teen hasn't thought of that?
Well, even younger than teens. I mean, if you've got kids that you feel like, oh, you know, my son is kind of making friends with the bully of the class, and maybe I don't really want them to hang around together so much. What should I do?
That's it.
You know, and it's a little different for teenagers, I'm sure, but we'll save that for later as well. So why don't we start with, this is your brain on Facebook.
This is your
That's how I thought of the study as I read it.
That's right. So this is a study done in London.
Ah, yes. Jolly old England.
Yes, England.
This pip, is pip.
In October of 2011, fairly recent.
Well, not too bad. You did all right.
So what they do, they take 125 college students, right?
Sure.
And they do MRIs, functional MRIs with these students.
Now, we've talked about MRIs before, and those are brain scans. But the cool thing about the functional MRIs is that they can really tell a little bit more about activities in different regions while you're doing things.
Yeah, so you're doing something and different parts of your brain are lighting up and they're trying to correlate what's happening in your real life
with your
brain.
Before you go on, I have to say, I'm reading this thing and this is after you had categorically rejected another study that was giving you a headache. And I'm sitting here looking at this with phrases like voxel-based morphometry. Right. And
well, I want to make sure you get the headache, not me.
Oh, I see. That's how it works. You just skipped over those paragraphs. So they're taking brain scans of these guys and figuring out, really what they're trying to figure out is where is their gray matter the densest?
That's right. It has nothing to do with how big their brain gets, right? I was joking about that.
It's the density.
It's the density of all those neurons and, you know.
This is it. So what does it mean if your gray matter is denser?
That's right. So, well, they look, first of all, I guess what they're trying to find out is, if you've got a lot of friends on Facebook, does that mean that that part of your brain that has been associated with social understanding and with memory as well, I think they looked at memory as well, but does that mean that part of your brain is lighting up more and there's more density?
There's more activity, there's more connections in that part of your brain. And there's been research in the past that looks at brain structures and how those kind of limit the social connections that people have in their real life or their offline friendship networks, right?
There's
certain brain areas, and the amygdala is a big one for offline social structures. And the amygdala is responsible for emotion and things like that. And so there's a limit to how many close relationships a person can have, and it's based on some aspects of brain capacity. And so they were also wondering, would it be different? Because we kind of think that online friendships might be different from offline friendships, and there hasn't been a lot of research comparing the two. So they said, well, if there is a difference between online and offline friendships, then maybe there are different brain areas that control how big those networks are going to be.
That's right. And so the amygdala, I guess what they know from previous research is that if this part of your brain is damaged, then you have a hard time seeing the emotion in facial expressions, for instance.
Right.
Right. So it affects your social interaction. And so, so they knew that from before. I guess one of the things they found is, yes, if you have a lot of friends on Facebook, like the more friends you have, the more density and more activation you see in this this frontal cortex area and the amygdala in particular. But also, that one of the differences they found between real life friendships and Facebook friendships is that memory, the area for memory in the brain was more activated too. Because if you think about it, you know, if in real life you might have 20 friends and on Facebook you have, you know, 800, you know, you have to have a pretty good memory to keep all of that going.
Well, they even looked at some specific areas that are responsible for face name connections, like being able to attach a face to a name. And obviously, if you're online, that's something that's maybe more, that's pretty important,
well,
right?
It is.
You really have to look back and think, okay, what's that person, you know? You don't always have a great big picture beside everything that they say. There's a tiny picture and usually it's kind of hard to make out.
Yes, that's right. Now, here's the other thing that I think was interesting. You know, when I think about Facebook, we're both on Facebook.
Yeah.
Not very often.
Actually, you know what? Facebook.com/familyanatomy now. There's a real official link.
There you go.
Well, with a name instead of a whole bunch of numbers. So Facebook.com/familyanatomy is where you find us.
That's it. Now, you know, usually when I think of Facebook and, you know, it's touted as, you know, how many, you say how many friends you have, right?
I never do.
You don't want to give that up, do you?
You know what? I don't even know how many friends I have on Facebook.
Okay, but you know what I mean? They call it friends. Really, it's more acquaintance networks, with some friends.
That's right. Right? That's right. It tends to be wider than your real social network.
Much wider. And so there, you know, a lot of people joke about that, you know, oh yeah, the person with, you know, 2,000 friends, but they never go out. they're always on the computer. They don't actually have friends per se. They just have these Facebook so-called friends. But the research is showing that having a lot of Facebook friends, mm-hmm. okay, actually means that you're more likely to have real life friends as well, like day to day out in your life friends.
They are linked together.
They are linked. Yeah. So it's not sort of the joke that you usually hear.
And they had some questions. I copied down some of the questions that they used to find out more about offline relationships. And they're questions like, how many people were there at your 18th birthday or your 21st birthday? I was trying to think about, I can't remember how many. How many people were, it's a long time ago for me, but these guys are 23 years old.
Yeah.
If you're going to have a party now, how many people would you invite? How many people in your phone book would you feel comfortable meeting up with in a small group? You know, questions like that. So they're really getting you to think about your social connections with people. So I thought that was, those questions to me were interesting. The other thing that I thought was a little bit funny is that you read these studies about brain structures and behavior, and the natural thing that you think of is, okay, well, if your brain is built a certain way, then certain things are going to happen in your life. If you have certain structures that are bigger or denser or more
active,
well, then that allows you to have a larger network on Facebook.
Our friends in general.
Friends in general, when we're talking more about the amygdala part. What they sort of questioned at the end was, okay, they said, we don't really know if this is nature or nurture.
Listen, you know, I give them so much credit for being straight up about that.
Well, I mean, right? That little paragraph at the very the
well,
last...
Well, sure, it is in the last page.
It's like two sentences on the last page.
Well, you expect to see it in the discussion section. So yep. I do give them credit for that, saying it's correlational. So it's not that you're born with necessarily that you're born with more dense activity in that part of your brain, the amygdala or frontal cortex, mm-hmm. And therefore you're going to have more friends. They talk about it being possible that it's more like neuroplasticity there, that you know, you're just the type of person that has gathered more friends for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's going to be reflected in some brain structures.
That exercises some areas of your brain, maybe. And so there's going to be more connections there, so to speak.
Yes.
Right? And the fact is, when you're talking about in 2011, right, is when the study came out. So it's possible they were talking to, the data was gathered in maybe 2010, right? It's a correlational study. It's not longitudinal. So maybe the data were gathered in 2011, but maybe 2010 also, because it takes time for things to be published. You know, these networks have been around for a long time now.
That's right.
You know, you'd say maybe like Friendster in the late 90s, and then in the early 2000s, there was MySpace, and that was one that really kind of started to take off. And then Facebook has been around since, well, in high schools in 2005.
750 million people on Facebook, you know, worldwide now.
There's lots of people on this network, and it has been around for a while. So the people in the study, to some extent, have grown up with these networks.
Right.
And of course, it's going to be some more than others, because early adopters would be the people who are more comfortable with computers and things like that. And it's only now that everybody's on it. So there could be all kinds of reasons why brain structures might be different for people who are more hooked in to the Facebook network. So it's good that they sort of mentioned that at least at the very end of the paper.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that sticks out for me as an implication of this is that, you know, let's say your son or daughter is on Facebook a lot. And like I say, a lot of people wonder if that just makes them more isolated in a way, because it's more screen time than real lifetime. Mm-hmm. But what it's saying is that Facebook actually is facilitating their social relationships. Like they're more likely to have real life friends too. The more friends they have on Facebook, the more likely it is that they actually have more real life friends than someone else who has fewer friends on Facebook.
Right. And I think partly that depends, like other research has shown, that partly depends on what they're using the service for, right? And if you're using it to facilitate real life contact, then that's a more positive thing. Whereas if you're using it to avoid, you know, people who are anxious in social situations, to avoid going out and meeting up with people in real life, that might be something different. And of course, everybody's different. We always talk about this research. It's always done on groups and people are individuals, right? So
that's right. So generally speaking, it's true that if you have more friends on Facebook, you have more friends in real life, but it's not going to be true in every case. Mm-hmm. I guess the thing is that the better your social relationships, like the better your mental and physical health. We know that from all kinds of research we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm. And possibly the bigger your brain is.
Oh,
wow. You know, I feel like I really understand that paper now that I have a really, between the two of us, we've really explained it very well.
Oh, nice segue.
You see how I did that?
Next.
Some things are better left unsaid is the title of the next one.
That's right. Journal of Consumer Research. This is a researcher from the University of Alberta School of Business, Sarah Moore.
Sarah Moore. Now, this was, first of all, when I saw she's from the School of Business, I scratched my head and said, why are we reading a research paper by someone who's in the School of Business?
And she, you know, if you read it, I guess as a consumer researcher, you have to look into psychology quite a bit to see how, what makes people motivated.
Right. To do the things that they do.
Yes.
And so we started looking into this story a little bit. We saw it on a news site where they were talking about how telling stories about things that happen in your life affect your feelings about those things that happen in your life. And so the examples that we were thinking of were like family vacations and kind of special things that you've done with people who you care about. And Sarah Moore is looking at this idea that depending on how you tell people about that later on, you might not feel so excited about it.
Later, for yourself, yeah. So if you've had an emotionally charged experience, whether it be something that was great or something that was terrible for you emotionally,
yeah,
right? And then if you go to tell someone about it and you start to describe the reasons why it was good or bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just sort of describing what it was like generally, descriptive words, or even how you feel about it is fine.
Yeah.
But the second you start saying, I liked it because of this, or I liked it, and here's some of the reasons I liked it,
mm-hmm.
and you're explaining it and making it more logical and literal that way,
yep.
it reduces both positive and negative emotions for you.
Well, you know, you probably feel that the most often when you're talking about movies that you've watched. When you think about, oh, you just went to the theater and oh, you feel like, oh, that was a great movie. And then you start analyzing it with your pals and you think, well, wait, maybe it wasn't as great as I thought it was.
But that's the funny thing. Like you could, so you've seen a movie and you came out and you thought it was an awesome movie, let's say, right?
Sure.
Now, you can say it was an awesome movie and I loved this about it and I loved that about it. And you remember the part where this happened, you remember mm-hmm. the part where that happened. If you start saying, I love the movie because of this, here's the reasons I loved this movie.
Right.
It tends to take away some of that feeling of awesomeness that you had for it. And then the opposite too, that if you had a terrible movie and you start to talk about the reasons you thought it was terrible, chances are you're going to start thinking of it a little better than you did initially.
Well, that's one of the things that therapists do, right? If you're working with someone who's had a really negative, traumatic kind of experience, what do? You process it, you analyze it, and that takes away some of the negative emotion that goes along with it. So what Sarah Moore found it was kind of neat what she did. They looked at reviews on Amazon of a number of books, and they found that people who used more explaining language and talked about why they liked a book or didn't like it were less likely to rate at the extreme end. So they were less likely to give 1 star or 5 stars because they were explaining it more, was her hypothesis. And then they had people experience real things or talk about real things that happened to them and looked at whether using explaining language kind of changed how much they or how they rated those experiences.
And so she generalized that research, that detail that you just talked about there. She's generalizing it to a lot of things. I know one of the examples she gave was, never ask your lover, why do you love me?
Ooh.
If you do that and they start trying to look for explanations for a feeling, the more they explain why they love you, chances are the less they're going to feel like they love you by the end of that conversation. So,
wow. From ratings on Amazon, yes, to don't talk about why you love your partner.
Why do you love me anyways? It's never a good question, by the way.
You know, there's you're right. Right? That's a story without a happy ending most, yes, of the time, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So there is that. There's also, in this research was interesting, that if you're talking about something that was great or something that you didn't appreciate at all, hated in an experience, and you're explaining it, it tends to reduce both of those emotions back to a more neutral
into
area.
Into the middle, yeah.
Right? The opposite is true, too. If you're doing something very neutral, let's say, you know, you're going to run an errand,
mm-hmm,
going to buy bread, you know, for dinner. Wow. Pretty. Well, I love bread, so I wouldn't choose that.
Yeah.
Toothpaste. Toothpaste. I got to go buy some toothpaste.
Oh, my gosh.
If I start talking to you about going to buy the toothpaste...
And look at why it was such a terrible experience, or why it was, or
just talk about the reasons why I did it and what happened and why it was either good or bad. I'm going to, by telling you that, I'm going to feel more emotion on something that's pretty neutral experience to begin with.
Right. When it's more of a consumption kind of a product. Obviously, they're looking at products, right? It's consumer research.
Next time I do a very boring errand.
Yeah.
I'm going to start talking about it in very exaggerated explanatory tones.
You should do that. And I'm sure that
my life satisfaction will go up.
Yeah. And your wife will say, why are you doing this to me?
No, she'll send me out for more toothpaste because she thinks I love it.
She thinks you love it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, wow, we actually managed to twist that around to talk a little bit about relationships, even though it's consumer research.
Now, if you send your teen out...
For errands. They might get into some trouble.
And they bump into a friend, yeah, that you're not crazy about.
Listen, this is something that parents know instinctively. There's been lots of research to show it, too. If your child is hanging around with delinquent friends...
This is our third story.
Exactly. They're more likely to get themselves into trouble. Forbidden friends as forbidden fruit. Parental supervision of friendships, contact with deviant peers, and adolescent delinquency.
Deviant peers. It's never a good thing if your child's hanging around with a deviant person.
Yeah. Okay?
It can't be good.
Well, no, it can. And they might say, oh, you don't really know them. Like you might be talking to your friends, to your kids about their friends and, oh, you don't know them and they're not really like that. And everybody just blames things on them. And it's like they're making excuses for these kids. And then the next week they're being bullied by the same person they were hanging around with. And it's like, you know, it's hard as a parent to hear those things because you could have predicted that something not very good was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it is hard, even with the kids at our age right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, your kids are getting up into the teen years, though, one of them at least.
I have an 11-year-old and another guy who's going to be 9 soon. Mm-hmm. And we've had to talk to them about sometimes their choices of friends because some of the people in their classes, that they both go to a small school. There's not a lot of, you know, there's not 3 different grade 4 classes or 3 different grade... There's 2 classes, and so one is French and one is English, and so you're kind of hanging around with the people in your class. That's not a huge group to choose from. So if there's one who's kind of making trouble and getting it sent to the office and things like, and that's the one that your child wants to hang around with and wants to invite over for sleepovers, you sort of say, well, wait a second.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, when I think about my own kids, I feel like what's happening there is if there's a kid who is seen as a leader, but he also has some questionable behaviors,
mm-hmm,
that's where I get more concerned because, you know, I can see that a lot of kids are kind of following this one kid and then including my own son,
yeah, right,
wants to be friends with this kid, having some problematic behaviors, but nothing too serious and nothing too out of control that you're too concerned about.
But these are things that could change as they're teenagers, right? Starting to make their own decisions more and spend more time away from home.
It definitely could. And they're spent, the research shows definitely are going, regardless of the kind of kid you have,
okay,
they're going to be spending more time with their peers than with you. That's what's going to happen. That's what the research shows.
Exactly.
So that is going to be more of a problem. But what I was going to say about my son is that the kids that are getting into so much trouble that they're not popular with their own peers.
Right.
That's a different story, and he's got enough good sense to, and he feels bad about it, but he stays away from those kids, and they might even want play dates, and he, you know, without even talking to me, has realized, I don't actually want to have that kind of person as a friend. Tends to be someone that's not just getting into trouble with teachers, but, you know, they're having trouble with their peers, and the peers are having bad feelings about them directly.
Right.
So
right.
If you're just making the teacher's life terrible, that's one thing.
Yeah. If you're a class clown, and I think that's where one of my kids, the one who we sometimes have to talk about his choices and who he's hanging around with, it tends to be the class clowns. He likes the funny guys.
Yeah.
Who tend to be silly.
They get into trouble sometimes with teachers, but other kids like them.
There you go.
So this study, there's 500 participants, teen boys, their friends, and their parents get given questionnaires over a two-year period.
It was really neat how they did it, because it's not just over time. It's a prospective study. They're catching these kids before they're getting involved with all of the delinquent stuff. And what the researchers wanted to know is what happens when parents try to control the friendships of their 13-year-olds.
Well, there's two things, actually. And you know, but you have to kind of dissect the words that they're using so that it gets a little mixed up. Let's make sure we're clear about it.
Sure.
One of them is parental prohibition.
Yep.
And the other one's parental control.
Yes.
So when you hear about it, you go, wow, isn't control prohibition?
No.
But in their research, no. The parental prohibition is, you can't hang around with Johnny or Jane.
That's right. And also making negative statements about, disapproving statements about the friendship and about the friend.
Right. But it's no, can't have that friend, versus parental control, which sounds like it could be that, but it's not.
No, it's
parental
less intrusive.
Control, yes, is who are your friends? Where are you going? What do you do when you go there? Just like knowing who they're with, when, where. You know,
it's more like monitoring than anything else. Yeah,
should be called parental monitoring.
That's what it should be called. But they called it control versus prohibition. So what are you going
to
do?
So that's the two types of parenting styles they're going to check to see, does it have any effect on hanging around with more deviant peers?
Mm-hmm.
And even later, does that mean that your child, by hanging around with the deviant peers, is more likely to be showing deviant behavior?
Yeah.
So what did they find, Dr. Brian?
Well, even before we talk about what they found, they chose these people on purpose because the kids in the study were at risk of developing deviant behavior. So they wanted to make sure they were going to have a big enough group of kids so that they could find out what predicts the delinquent stuff. And they did that by catching them in grade 6 and having their teachers fill out a questionnaire to show that they were having some trouble with aggressive behaviors and breaking the rules and arguing and having a hot temper and things like that. So already the kids in the study are kids who might over time get into some trouble once they're teenagers. And then the study actually began when they were 13 and they were followed every year. Well, one of the things they found was that if a teenager is hanging out with people who are delinquent over time, there will be an increase in that kid's delinquent behavior.
And that's kind of common sense, right? That's common sense.
Yep.
The more interesting finding there is that if the parent, let's not use their terms, it gets confusing for people, I think. If the parent says, no, you can't hang around with Johnny and Jane, period, makes it more likely they're going to hang around with Johnny and Jane.
They spend more time with delinquent peers a year later if their parents are trying to stop them having those friendships.
Yes, and 2 years later, they're going to have more deviant and delinquent behavior.
Exactly. This is a big issue, and I think it's an important thing for parents to know. Parents need to hear these results and understand that if you're stopping your kids from hanging around with
those
friends,
just say no doesn't work.
That's right. You can't just control who they're hanging around with and expect then that they're not going to be getting into trouble or they're not going to be spending time with those people.
That's right. Now, the other parenting style that we're going to call
monitoring,
not
indeed.
Control.
No,
monitoring.
Right.
So if you're monitoring who your kids are with, where they're going, what's happening, and everything else, then there is no link. Like they're not as likely to be hanging around with those deviant kids, and 2 years later, they're not as likely to be having any deviant behavior.
Right. It wasn't related to any increases in the kinds of kids that they were going to be hanging around with.
Much more effective to monitor.
Right.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about that is like why is it better to monitor instead of just saying no?
Right? Well,
what I got from it at least was that kids, and I guess they've done surveys of kids to see what they feel is their sort of
in
right,
their domain.
Purview.
Yeah.
You know, like I get to choose my own friends. Mm-hmm. So that's my own thing. You don't really have any say over that.
Even younger kids believe that, right?
Right. And so if you're trying to do that, you're kind of impinging on that autonomous part that they've started to develop there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably a lot of resentment and you don't get any listening. If, on the other hand, you're just monitoring it, now they have choices. They can give you full disclosure. They can give about what they're doing or not doing.
Sure.
They can give you partial disclosure. They can out and out lie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have all these different things they could do, and that's just reality.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the thing that's important for parents to remember is that the better their relationship with their son or daughter, the more likely they're going to get the full disclosure that keeps them more safe, gives you more of an opportunity to keep them away from these kids, because now we're just having a discussion with full disclosure as opposed to just prohibition. No, you can't. No, you can't.
It comes back to communication and relationship again and again and again. And anytime we're talking about kids, all of the best outcomes come from having that relationship where you can speak to one another, having that relationship where your child or your teenager cares about what you think and is comfortable enough telling you what they're up to, so that you're more likely to get honest responses in those situations. And honestly, when you look at the reasons why the researchers were trying to explain and kind of fit in with a model of why kids might be less comfortable or more likely to hang around with those inappropriate friends when their parents were more controlling, it was because they're at a stage where they're looking for more independence. And we're talking about an area that they feel they should have some control over and some choice and some say. And so if the parents are too controlling in that circumstance, that mismatch between what they need at that stage in their life in terms of developing their independence and what they're getting is going to drive them towards those friends instead of towards the parents.
That's it. So you're trying to match their stage of development there. I know there was another study that they talked about in this study that showed that if you're giving autonomy too early to an adolescent, in their early adolescence, then they're more poorly adjusted. If you're giving autonomy in late adolescence to an appropriate way, then they're less likely to be depressed. So you have to kind of, you know, feel your own child out for that and make sure you're giving the right level of autonomy for their stage through the teen years.
This is true. I mean, you have to have some expectations, but it comes back to not focusing on the specific behavior of who, you know, you're hanging around with these people and I don't want you to hang around with those people, so I'm going to control who you're with and manage your time. And instead focusing on your relationship with the kids.
That's it. And, you know, it brings to mind what Dr. Gordon Neufeld was also talking about, because I know there was some research that showed that if you're oriented towards your peers at an early age, it leads to more delinquency. So you want them to be more oriented towards you as parents than to their peers. How are you going to do that? Through a better relationship, through better communication, through more full disclosure on their part, which has to do with you having a better relationship with them.
The fact is, if the parent is the more important role model than the peers, even if the kids are hanging around with the deviant friends, they're going to be thinking about their parents in those circumstances and are going to get in less trouble.
That's right.
It's protective. That relationship is protective against those things. And parents just cannot get this message often enough, in my opinion. They need to hear that it's the relationship and it's not controlling the behavior that's important.
And it's not fear-based. You know, fear-based is not the way you're going to have a better relationship, you know?
No, I mean, they're becoming less afraid of you in the
grounding,
teen years.
The, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
That's not how you're going to have a better relationship with better disclosure. And so that, yes, when they get into those situations, which are going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, kids, you know, kids are going to get into some trouble in their teen years.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to happen. But are you part of that experience, like you were saying, when it does happen?
Yeah.
It's more likely that you're going to be there in their mind if you've nurtured that relationship and not, again, not made it a fear-based thing.
That's right. And the monitoring isn't about, it isn't the fear-based thing at all. The monitoring is something where the kids know what's important to you, right? That monitoring gives them an idea of what your values are and what your expectations are, without putting the kind of the thumb over top of them and saying, okay, this is how we're going to do it.
But they care about what your values and expectations are because you've developed a good relationship with them
and
where they
showing,
trust you and you're showing your trust for them.
You're showing your trust for them. You're showing respect for them too. So it winds up being this two-way street. And when they need that autonomy, they're feeling like you're giving it to them without kind of throwing them to the wolves either.
No doubt.
Because you're keeping track of them.
That's it.
So I just thought that was such a great study to be talking about on our show tonight, but that brings us to the end.
You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or you can email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook, now at facebook.com/familyanatomy. You can find us on Twitter, and as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, and he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks.
It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do.
FamilyAnatomy.com.